Chapter 8. The Quimby Years. The serpent beguiled me, and I did eat. Genesis. 1862. There were numerous articles in the New England newspapers in the early 1860s regarding the marvelous cures of Dr. P.P. Quimby of Portland, Maine. One New Hampshire editor had written, "There is a good deal said about Dr. Quimby of Portland, and it may not be considered amiss to mention the case of a young lady of this town who has been greatly benefited by him. For nearly 3 years, she has been an invalid, a great part of the time confined to her bed, and never left the room unless carried out by her friends. A few weeks since, she heard of Dr. Quimby, and resolved to visit him. She did so, and after remaining under his care 4 days, she returned home free from all pain and disease, and is now rapidly regaining health and strength. The increasing respect and confidence of the public in his success suggests the day of miracles, and brings up a question as absurd as that of 2,000 years ago. Quote, can any good come out of Nazareth? End quote. Can actual disease be cured by a humbug? Dr. Quimby effects his cures without the aid of medicine or outward applications, and his practice embraces cases like the above, where all ordinary treatment has failed to relieve. Not fearing to investigate the operation of the mind, he penetrates the region where nothing but magicians, sorcerers, witchcraft, and spiritualists have ventured, and going far beyond them in his experiments, he arrives at the principle of regulating happiness." It may have been this very article that had prompted Daniel to write to Quimby the previous fall, and this article, or another, had confirmed Mary's feeling that miracles of healing were possible today, even as they had been by the Sea of Galilee. She had chosen a more conventional treatment, but she had not forgotten the claims of miraculous cures in seemingly hopeless cases. And once again, her condition seemed utterly hopeless. She wrote to Dr. Quimby in despair. Hill, August 1862. Dr. P.P. Quimby. Dear Sir, I am constrained to write you, feeling as I do the great mistake I made in not trying to reach you when I had more strength. I have been at this water cure between 2 and 3 months, and when I came, could walk 1/2 mile. Now I can sit up but a few minutes at one time. Suppose I have faith sufficient to start for you. Do you think I can reach you without sinking from the effects of the journey? I am so excitable, I think I could keep alive till I reached you, but then would there be foundation sufficient for you to restore me, is the question. I should rather die with my friends at S. Bridge. Hence I shall go to you to live, or to them to die very soon. Please answer this yourself. Truly yours, Mary M. Patterson. Phineas Parkhurst Quimby was born in Lebanon, New Hampshire, February 16, 1802. When he was 2 years old, his family moved to Belfast, Maine, where he grew up. As a boy, he had very little education, and at an early age was apprenticed to a clockmaker, at which profession he did well, for he was patient and exacting. He was small of stature and had a keen, inquiring mind. When mesmerism was first introduced into New England, He studied it on his own and soon discovered that he had a remarkable ability in that area. Before long, he was giving lectures and demonstrations and soon gave up his clockmaking to devote full time to mesmerism. In time, his rare humanity caused him to devote his ability to relieve the suffering. He developed advanced views on the subject of magnetic healing and felt that he had left mesmerism for this nobler profession. By 1862, he maintained a large suite of rooms at the International Hotel in Portland, where he both lived and carried on his work. Dr. Quimby responded to Mrs. Patterson's letter encouragingly, so she enlisted the aid of her older brother Samuel and his wife Mary Ann, who lived in Boston, to assist her in making the trip. It was strictly an act of kindness on their part, for Mrs. Baker wrote later, "Both my husband and myself made careful inquiries in regard to Mr. Quimby's system of treatment while Mrs. Eddy was under his care, and we considered his methods to be the essence of quackery." Nevertheless, to Mary it was a last hope, so the considerate sister-in-law gave of her time and aid to help the feeble invalid, who once again was unable to dress or even to stand without assistance. Thus, on the 10th of October, this party of three arrived in Portland, one with expectant hope, the other two with dubious misgivings. Mary Patterson was, at the time she arrived at the International Hotel, very much as the woman who only touched the hem of Jesus' robe and was healed. For from the moment she met Dr. Quimby, it could be said of her too, "Woman, thy faith hath made thee whole." She found almost immediate relief from her physical suffering, but she found even more than that. She found sympathetic understanding for the first time since the loss of her mother 13 years earlier. Many years later, Mrs. Eddy wrote of Dr. Quimby, quote, "On his rare humanity and sympathy, one could write a sonnet," end quote. For many, many years, Mary had been seeking a scientific cause and cure for disease, and she now thought that she had found it in the advanced views of Phineas Quimby. However, he was learning more from her than she was from him, which he readily acknowledged. She was not only the most remarkable woman he had ever met, but the most remarkable woman the world has ever seen. Although not a religious man, Quimby was honest and good, and he saw Mary Patterson's mission more clearly than she then did when he made the statement, quote, "I see now what you mean, and I see that I am John, and that you are Jesus," end quote. The parallel offended Mary's religious sense, but Quimby was very close to right. Many years later, she was compelled to deny Quimby even as Jesus had denied John the Baptist, saying, quote, "He that is least in the kingdom of heaven is greater than John," end quote. Quimby's mental healing was strictly the use of the human mind, combined with physical manipulation. Science and Health now says of those who promote such practice, quote, "They regard the human mind as a healing agent, whereas this mind is not a factor in the principle of Christian Science," end quote. And it asks those scientists who cling to a personal sense of mind and matter, quote, When will the ages understand the ego and realize only one God, one mind, or intelligence? End quote. But in 1862, neither Mrs. Patterson nor Dr. Quimby understood his method of healing. Another of Dr. Quimby's patients, the latter part of 1862, was Emma Morgan, whom he treated for severe neuralgia. Her father, W.P. Morgan, offered Quimby $1,000 to explain his method of treating disease, to which the doctor replied, "I cannot. I do not understand it myself." The spiritual Mrs. Patterson had advanced views of her own on mental therapeutics, and she and Dr. Quimby spent many hours discussing the subject and sharing their views and experiences. Mary was never lukewarm on any subject, and in the fall of 1862, P.P. Quimby was her savior. He had wrought wonders, and her praise was lavish. She stayed in Portland after Samuel and Mary Ann returned to Boston, moving into Mrs. Martha Hunter's boarding house, where other Quimby patients were living. One of the latter was Mr. Julius Dresser, whom she first met at the Hydropathic Institute in Hill. He had noted her arrival on October 10th and wrote in his diary a week later, "The most peculiar person I have seen of late is Mrs. Patterson, the authoress who came last Friday, a week ago today, from Vale's Water Cure in Hill, New Hampshire, where Melville, Fanny Bass, and I were, and is now under Dr. Quimby and boarding also at Mrs. Hunter's. She was only able to get here, and no one else thought she could live to travel so far. But today, she, with Mrs. Hunter and sister, Nettie and I went up into the dome of the new city building, up 7 flights of stairs, or 182 steps. So much for Dr. Quimby's doings." Mary spent every moment extolling the doctor's praises and endeavoring to fit his cures into her evolving theory of God, man, and the universe on a scientific basis. During their long conversations, he asked her to look over his notes, which were descriptions of his patients and their disease, and to put them in grammatical form. When correcting, she added some of her own ideas at his request. He adopted some of her terminology, including the term science, which he had not used previously. Mrs. Patterson was aware that she had no clear understanding of her miraculous recovery. She knew a great discovery was involved, and thought erroneously that Quimby, rather than herself, was the discoverer. On the 7th of November, she wrote a letter to the Portland Courier, which read in part, "I can see dimly at first, and only as trees walking, the great principle which underlies Dr. Quimby's faith and works. And just in proportion to my right perception of truth is my recovery. That this is a science capable of demonstration becomes clear to the minds of those patients who reason upon the process of their cure. At present, I am too much in error to elucidate the truth, and can touch only the keynote for the master hand to make the harmony. May it be in essays instead of notes, say I. After all, this is a very spiritual doctrine. But the eternal years of God are with it, and it must stand firm as the rock of ages. And to many a poor sufferer, may it be found, as by me, the shadow of a great rock in a weary land. The only patient Quimby had who reasoned upon the process of his cures was Mrs. Patterson, and she was wishing that he had essays she could read for enlightenment, rather than notes which needed elucidation. The spirituality was in Mrs. Patterson's theory, rather than Dr. Quimby's doctrine, but it was many years before she understood this, plus the fact that Quimby's practice was a benevolent form of mesmerism. When she did understand it, she wrote, "The material body manifests only what mortal mind believes. We say that one human mind can influence another, and in this way affect the body. But we rarely remember that we govern our own bodies. The operator would make his subjects believe that they cannot act voluntarily and handle themselves as they should. If they yield to this influence, it is because their belief is not better instructed by spiritual understanding." At this time, her belief was not better instructed by spiritual understanding, and she yielded completely to Quimby's influence. But she had touched the keynote of the science of man, and the master hand would make the harmony of being clear to her. But that master hand was infinite mind, not a mortal man. From the time of Mary's recovery, her thought had been to secure Daniel's release from prison. And to this end, she sought the aid of Daniel's brother, John, in nearby Saco, Maine, and of Governor Barry of New Hampshire, both of whom responded. But before embarking on her planned trip to Washington, she learned that Daniel had escaped from prison and was safe. By mid-December, he had joined her in Portland, and shortly thereafter, they returned to Sanborn Bridge. Mary had gone a step beyond homeopathy into the mental realm from the day she first met Dr. Quimby. From him, she had learned the power of positive thinking to produce health and the power of negative thinking to produce disease. His humanitarianism had won her heart, and she was a staunch disciple, endeavoring to practice her interpretation of his theory, both on herself and others. But she needed his mental visits, as did many of his patients, when they were away from his magnetic, personal presence, as her letter of January 12 indicates. Sanborn Bridge, January 12, 63. Dr. P.P. Quimby. Dear Sir, yours of recent date was received with pleasure. My felon finger must account for bad penmanship in answering it. Yesterday I took care of a woman in fits, and in the spasm she grasped my finger, which has made it somewhat troublesome today. Your angel visit here removed all my stomach pain, the particulars of which were very remarkable, and sometime I will narrate them to you. I am to all who once knew me a living wonder and a living monument of your power. 5 or 6 of my friends are going to visit you. My sister, Mrs. Tilton, will not find it convenient to leave at present. I am at this time with her, and company from Boston will detain her at present. She wishes me to accompany her son to Portland to see you, and probably he will visit you soon. I eat, drink, and am merry. Have no laws to fetter my spirit now, though I am quite as much of an escaped prisoner as my dear husband was. Many thanks for your kind wishes for my future. I mean not again to look mournfully into the past, but wisely to improve the present, and go forth to meet the future with a woman's courage. I somewhat expect my husband will take up arms to serve our nation's rights. He yearns to do it, and I shall try to acquiesce. The doctor wishes to be kindly remembered. Yours ever, Mary M. Patterson. Daniel Patterson was yearning for adventure and not at all eager to assume responsibility. Mary was longing for a home of her own, but Daniel seemed perfectly contented to accept the largess of their relatives. By the end of January, her old ailments were returning, and she again wrote the doctor for help, stating, "Yet, if it were not for visiting, I could manage myself, but not being at home, I have no tranquility wherewith to aid myself." March found Mary still in Sandmorton Bridge, writing to a friend in Portland. "I will try to send my philosophy by Mrs. Tilton when she accompanies her son to the International Hotel in Portland." Daniel was still dallying, wandering about New England, speaking here and there wherever he could find listeners about his prison experience. He neither enlisted in the service nor showed any inclination toward resuming his profession. With no house to call her own, Mary was beginning to feel tempest-tossed. A constant visitor in the homes of others, she seemed unable to maintain the health she thought she had found. So, for lack of home and health, she returned to Portland in the summer of 1863. That fall and winter, she was still a visitor, this time with one or another of Daniel's relatives in Saco, when she was not in Portland. When she was in Portland, she spent almost every afternoon in long conversations with Dr. Quimby, and every evening at her boarding house, writing, often far into the night. Some of her writing was for the local press, but most of it was on the subject nearest her heart, spiritual healing. Those manuscripts were left with Dr. Quimby and were the source of much trouble years after her great discovery. Dr. Quimby and Mrs. Patterson had much in common, for they both had natural qualities that spiritualists attributed to mediums, such as second sight and the ability to read people's minds. But both had rejected spiritualism as being false and often fraudulent. They both had integrity and honesty and were dedicated to serving mankind. But Mrs. Patterson had a spirituality which Quimby did not possess. He was well aware of this fact and readily acknowledged her spirituality and its import for the progress of the human race. Had he lived, one has little doubt that he would have become an adherent of Christian Science and a devout follower of Mrs. Eddy after reading his article, Man and Woman. Man, like the earth, is throwing off a vapor, and that contains his knowledge. Out of this vapor comes a more perfect identity of living matter, more rarefied than the former, and consequently in danger of being devoured by it. The latter life is less gross, therefore more spiritual, so that what it loses in physical strength, it receives from a higher power approaching God or science. This science is the wisdom of God that controls the intellect. As the earth is composed of different kinds of soil, so man varies from the lowest grade of animal intelligence to that higher state of consciousness, which can receive science. The spiritual rib that rises from man is more perfect matter or soil, called woman. I do not mean that woman means every female, nor do I pretend to say that man means everything of the animal, but that the mind of the female contains more of that superior substance required to receive the higher development of God's wisdom. For this element is pure love. The male creation feeds on the lower order of life. It makes the higher order a sort of pet for a while. The natural man sports and plays with the female, while the purer part of his nature is sympathizing with its own love in a higher soil or life. The animal life is prowling around to devour the little pleasure that is striving to grow in this barren soil. This keeps science down, for it is not known to the natural man. But put this science into the life or soil of the female, and then she is safe from the animal life, and it puts her in possession of a science that the natural man knows nothing of. It separates her from matter and brings her into that spiritual state that rises from all animal life with a knowledge of its character. Like a chemist, she then stands among all kinds of matter which are under her control and which she has the power of changing. Then she becomes a teacher of that science, which puts man in possession of a wisdom that can subject all animal life to his own control and separate the wisdom of this world from the wisdom of God. Then woman becomes a teacher of the young, and man stands to woman as a servant to his Lord, ready to investigate all phenomena by science. As the soil of California is rich enough to produce gold, so the soul or the life of the female is rich enough to produce the wisdom of God. It does not follow that the life of woman is the only soil capable of producing science, but it contains more spiritual wisdom than is found in man. This is as it should be, and if it could be admitted by man, so that woman could have her place in the life of man, the world would in a short time be rid of the scourges. Quimby saw that Mrs. Patterson gave a spiritual interpretation to his theories he had never dreamed of. He also saw that this spirituality carried over to her practice of his theories, for she relied wholly on mind and never manipulated patients as he did. It may have been the following case which caused him to write, quote, "Like a chemist, she then stands among all kinds of matter which are under her control, and which she has the power of changing." End quote. A woman was taking her dying husband to his old home in Canada, but a doctor on the train advised moving him to the nearest hotel at the next station which was Portland. Mrs. Patterson was at the hotel when they arrived, and shortly thereafter she heard that the husband had passed away. She went to the door of the bereaved wife, and when it was opened in response to her knock, tried to comfort her. She said, "Let us go and waken him." They went, and she stood beside him for a few minutes and told his wife that he was waking and that she must be close by so that he could see her when he opened his eyes, which he shortly did. He said to his wife, "Oh, Martha, it was so strange to be at home, and you not there." And he spoke about meeting his parents and others of the family who died before. Mary had perceived undying life, and Martha had witnessed that Christ could raise the dead in the 19th century, as in the first. Martha's husband was living when Mary Patterson left the hotel 3 days later. Mrs. Sarah G. Crosby had journeyed from Albion, Maine, to be treated by Dr. Quimby in the fall of 1863. In Portland, she met Mrs. Patterson, and there was an immediate affinity between the two women. They roomed in the same boarding house in the winter of 1863-64. And when Mrs. Crosby returned to her home, it was with the promise that Mrs. Patterson would visit her very soon. Before Mary had started for Albion, she received a pleading letter from another of Dr. Quimby's patients, Miss Mary Ann Jarvis, to come to visit her in Warren, Maine. It was a call for help, so with the doctor's blessing, she embarked upon her mission of mercy, arriving at Miss Jarvis' home late in March. The house was a difficult one to be in, full of sickness and fears, one of which was that Mrs. Patterson would not stay. She did stay for 2 months and helped Miss Jarvis greatly, but at great expense to her own health. Quimby's method of first taking the patient's illnesses upon himself and then casting them off was more detrimental to the inquiring spiritual thought of Mrs. Patterson than it was to the benevolent magnetic thought of the doctor. And two, she was still a visitor in someone else's home. She wrote to Quimby on the 31st of March, "I do not want to return to Portland to stop if I can avoid it. If I could have my husband with me and be at home, I would like it there. But I like people of common sense and common justice, or else I like to laugh where the joke comes in. I cannot be deceived in character. I have seen not a little of life in most conditions, and I cannot stoop to conditions. I will not bow to wealth, for I cannot honor it as I do wisdom, and I despise an individual who does. I respect my household God, and give it an identity. Call it by no name, but always know it when I see it. It never appears in envy or jealousy, but loves all good attainments in everyone, pleased to acknowledge them better than riches, and exalting above all else their possessor." No doubt it was Quimby's appreciation of womanhood in general, and of Mrs. Patterson in particular, that caused her to take her courage in her hands and begin lecturing at this period of her experience for speaking in public by women had always been all but forbidden by custom. Her adorable mother had never even offered audible prayer for her assembled family in her own home, though they had such every day. For a man was expected to be the head of the family and to do the speaking. It is not surprising that one of her first reviews, though praiseworthy of her appearance, intelligence, and presentation, also said, quote, "This lady is not in the habit of public speaking. At least we should judge so from the tone of her voice, which was too feminine to fill the hall." End quote. A lecture she delivered in Warren was the main topic of her letter of April 10th to Dr. Quimby. She said in part, "Somehow I am impressed to write you, as the spiritualists call it. Last Wednesday at 12 a.m., I saw you in this parlor where I am now writing. You wore a hat and dress coat. I said to your doctorship, 'How do you do?' Whereupon you answered not again, but left, which I called dodging the question. Well, I sighed, am sorry I spoke. But really, he need not have gone so suddenly. I was not intending to ask him to have stayed to my lecture, but I did see you and was not thinking of you at that time." The lecture was thinly attended, but the precious few were those whom a lady present, the manufacturer's wife, said were the upper tandem. Only think of Yankee castes in all our country villages. I thoroughly wish we were understood as a people, the true American idea. One first reason of my thinking to lecture here at all was the general opinion that I was a spiritualist. This came, as I were told, from one of your patients reporting here that you were such. I began like this, to correct any misconceived ideas on the subject. We would first say that a belief in spiritualism, as defined by wrappings, trances, or any agency in healing the sick, coming from the dead, we wholly disclaim. Had a letter from the editor of The Independent to write for his widely circulated journal. But I am not strong enough to step out upon the waves yet. I fear at least wetting my feet. Wrote him I were not able. I long, long to be strong. Dr. Quimby had used the word wisdom in endeavoring to explain his cures, and Mrs. Patterson had translated it to mean God in her philosophy. This synonym for deity appears in her letter of April 24th, as does reference to the second lecture she delivered in Warren. Warren, April 24th, 1864. Dear Doctor, I am a little bit lonesome, doing and suffering. Am wishing I was around the home hearth with my child and husband amid the joys of liberty. The cup which my father, Wisdom, hath prepared for me, shall I not drink it? To our material sense, 'tis even at times gall. But he that forsaketh not father and mother to follow me is not worthy of me. Doctor, I have a strange feeling of late that I ought to be perfect after the command of science in order to know and do the right. so much as I need to attain before that makes the job look difficult, but I shall try. When men and above all women revile me, to forgive and pity. When I am misjudged because misunderstood, to feel wisdom, forgive them, for they know not what they do. All things shall work together for good to them who love wisdom. I can love only a good, honorable, and brave career. No other can suit me. If I could use my pen, as I long to do, and not sink under it, I would work after this model till it should appear a thing of beauty, which is a joy forever. I have changed my lecture to suit the occasion. This seems to me a spiritual need of this people. I like much the hearts of worn folks, i.e., better than their heads. They are very respectful and kind to me. Would you have the courage to attend, if here? Sometimes wisdom is known by her followers. Mary truly outlined her own future in this letter, to be perfect after the command of science, and to use her pen to work after this model, till it should appear a thing of beauty, which is a joy forever. But her cup seemed a bitter one at this juncture. She had a semblance of health for the first time in her life, but not a spot on this earth to call her own. The foxes have holes, and the birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man hath not where to lay his head. How dearly she learned what she later wrote in Science and Health. Home is the dearest spot on earth. She was still in Warren in May of 1864, planning to go on to visit the young widow in Albion, Sarah Crosby, when her plans were quickly changed by news from Daniel. She went instead to Lynn, Massachusetts, for he was opening a dental office there. But in Lynn, she found neither a genial husband nor a happy home. So before the end of the summer, she sought refuge in Albion. The visit meant much to her friend, for Mrs. Crosby recalled those days fondly after the lapse of nearly 20 years. She wrote to Mrs. Eddy in 1903, "In fancy, I often go back to the old farmhouse in Albion, as it was 40 years ago with Grandma Crosby, the presiding spirit, ruling as with a rod, the rather too yielding nominal mistress of the household, the brood of noisy children frolicking from cellar to garret, the hired girls and hired men forming a little colony by themselves. These form the background of a picture in which the central figures are two lone women. The one, fired with a prescience of a great mission, even in the depths of poverty, looking forth upon the world, conscious of coming power. The other, peering wistfully into a future that seemed full of shadows, yet with the aspirations of a young goddess. Days and nights they sat in the little chamber of the one, or the nursery of the other, in such communion of soul as is seldom experienced by mortals, so full of tender love and sympathy for each other. Mary's visit was the most stimulating and inspiring experience of Mrs. Cosby's life. A short time thereafter, she took up the study of stenography and became one of the earliest female court reporters in New England, which gave her independence and wealth. During these weeks of companionship, the topic nearest Mary's heart was true spiritual healing and correlatively the refutation of spiritualism, which was gaining in popularity during the war years. As Mary had written to Dr. Quimby, she liked to laugh where the joke comes in, and she thought one day to have a good laugh with her friend while proving her point regarding mediums. She suddenly simulated a trance and in a low voice said that this was Albert Baker, warning Mrs. Crosby that in spite of his great love for his sister, and even though she loved Mrs. Crosby as much as she was capable of loving anyone, she might use their sacred confidences to further any ambitious purposes of her own. But there was no laughter where the joke came in. Mary had underestimated the credulity of her friend. From that moment, Sarah Crosby believed, as Mary had said, that Albert Baker was her guardian spirit. Little wonder, in an early edition of Science and Health, Mrs. Eddy wrote, "We have explained to the class calling themselves spiritualists how their signs and wonders are wrought, and have illustrated by doing them. But at the same time have said, this is not the work of spirits, and I am not a medium. And they have passed from our presence and said, behold the proof that she is a medium." One day, after the weeks of her visit had turned to months, Daniel appeared in Albion. He was seemingly repentant for his infidelity, and Mary returned with him to Lynn. But his repentance was not genuine, for on the 14th of December in 1864, Sarah Crosby wrote Mary that she had received an amorous letter from Dr. Patterson. Nevertheless, Mary continued to try to hold her marriage together, while Daniel's behavior grew more brazen and despicable. Though not the helpless invalid she had been, Mary was still far from well and strong. In April, she made another short trip to Portland to see Dr. Quimby. The following month, the little doctor retired from his busy practice in Portland and returned to Belfast. In June, Dr. Patterson again left his wife for several months. His agreement to send her $4 a week in his absence was kept for the first 4 weeks only. Alone and without funds, how she longed for human comfort and understanding. Healing was ever in Mary's thought, for her health was so precarious. When she had tried to talk about spiritual healing with Daniel, he laughed at her. Mrs. Tilton had grown disinterested in mental healing when Quimby had failed to cure her son of alcoholism. To her father, Mark Baker, the topic was offensive, and he had said so in less than gentle terms. Quimby was the only one with whom she could discuss her unfolding ideas, so she had turned to him much as she had turned to her sympathetic mother in earlier years. For 3 years, her visits with the gentle doctor had been like an oasis in a weary world. But this relationship was not to last much longer. In October of 1865, Quimby had an experience which was new to him, in that he could not rid himself of the disease which he had taken on from a patient. He grew steadily worse and died 3 months later on the 16th of January, 1866. Mary had had a brief interlude of sympathetic understanding in her acquaintance with Dr. Quimby, but she had no idea of the cost involved. Though she knew it not, she had seen the working of good mortal mind, and she was destined to experience its opposite, the working of wicked mortal mind, before many more years had passed. Perhaps both experiences were necessary for the discoverer to find the way and point it out clearly for all of her children on this earth.